Francisco, thank you very much for the very nice introduction and invitation. Thank you also to Noya Lustig, who I've known and worked with for, I don't know for how long, at least 15 years, and followed her to lots of places, including Puebla, Mexico, to participate in things. So it's a real pleasure to come to New Orleans, which is truly one of my favorite cities, and I have a niece and nephew who are both here at Tulane and are here, so it's nice to visit them, and a partner who's from New Orleans, so it's really nice to be here. So as Ludovico mentioned, I do like to be interrupted so that I don't just talk for an hour. And I'm perfectly capable of standing up here and talking for an hour and putting everybody to sleep. So please interrupt me and then everybody will be more engaged. I'm the last of six kids, so I'm used to being interrupted all the time. Okay, so as you know, this particular presentation is based on my new book, which is called Happiness Around the World, The Paradox of Happy Peasants and Miserable Millionaires. And there are lots of topics covered in the book, including, you know, what are the determinants of happiness around the world, and I'll get to that. But I want to focus the presentation on a real puzzle that's come out of the book, and I think it's a real puzzle before we think about happiness surveys, the results of happiness research in the policy arena. And there's a lot of talk about putting this stuff in the policy arena. I don't know if you all have heard of the Sarkozy Commission, or this big call for using well-being indicators. The British government has an office in Whitehall devoted to the development of national well-being indicators. The National Science Foundation here has a very large effort looking at the health of national well-being indicators, which I'm part of. But I think this particular question throws a big monkey wrench into what is otherwise a very promising methodology and approach and way of measuring welfare that I think can make us understand human well-being better. So, and this question is, why do some individuals who are destitute report to be very happy, while others who are very wealthy and have good health and everything else report to be miserable? And I focused on the role of norms and adaptation in trying to explain this puzzle. And it's a puzzle that I've called either the paradox of happy peasants and miserable millionaires, or also the paradox of happy peasants and frustrated achievers, and both will come out as I talk a little more. So adaptation is the subject of a lot of work in economics, but it's really a psychological term. And adaptations are defense mechanisms, and they're bad ones like paranoia, and they're good ones like humor, sublimation, and anticipation. The psychologists debate a lot about something called the set point theory, which basically says that people can adapt to anything, bad health, divorce, poverty, high levels of crime and corruption, and return to their natural level of cheerfulness. And there are a lot of famous studies of quadriplegics and paraplegics who a year later seem to be as happy as they were. Even though they were very unhappy right after their accident, they managed to adapt back. Now, whether or not you buy this theory, I think there's things that people don't adapt back from, and there's some nice new evidence in economics that there are certain things like long-term unemployment, which is very relevant to the current crisis here, that people don't seem to adapt back from. But whether or not you believe that people fully adapt back or not, in my view, is irrelevant. What we do know is that people are remarkably adaptable. So my studies certainly suggest this. And the most recent place I studied happiness, and a rather unlikely one, was Afghanistan. And it turns out that people in Afghanistan are as happy as Latin Americans, and 20% more likely to smile in a day than are Cubans, even though objective conditions in Afghanistan are much worse than in Latin America, surely, and even than in Cuba. Kenyans, meanwhile, are as satisfied with their health as our people in the United States. And that doesn't, you know, what explains that? Well, that people adapt to bad conditions and report to be satisfied with them. And at one level, how can this not be a good thing? You know, if you live in a terrible place and you have no alternative, it's probably a good thing to preserve your individual psychological welfare by being able to make the best of it, right? So I think it probably is from an individual psychological perspective, but a lot of what I've been looking at suggests that it can also result in collective tolerance for very bad equilibrium, for high levels of crime and corruption, for persistent poverty, bad health. So I'm going to run through some examples in the economics arena, crime and corruption, and health in the presentation. But before that, I think it's important to talk a little bit about happiness economics, both the method and what we know about the determinants of happiness around the world. So what is happiness economics? Well, about 10 years ago, if you said you worked on happiness economics, you were basically laughed out of the room. In fact, my first manuscript on happiness which I wrote 10 years ago, was called Happiness and Hardship. And the then director of economic studies, who was a good friend of mine and wonderful colleague, said, you know, Carol, this is a great manuscript, but you've got to take happiness out of the title because nobody's going to take you seriously. So I kept happiness in the title and didn't sell many books. In contrast, this little book that I just finished seems to be popping up all over the place, and as are articles on happiness. And in fact, happiness has now sparked major debates in the mainstream of economics, and the current president of the American Economics Association, Angus Deaton, is quite involved in doing happiness research. So we've certainly, I wouldn't say we're in the mainstream, but we've certainly at least captured the attention of people in the mainstream. So what is it? It's a method that combines the tools and methods of economists, basically large-scale surveys and econometric approaches, with those typically used by psychologists, and that is primarily asking people what they think rather than just looking at what they do. And it's a good way of capturing broader elements of welfare than do just plain income data. And I'm not suggesting we shouldn't use income data, but the information that comes in happiness surveys is a good complement to income data. And it's a method that's, I think, is particularly well suited for answering questions where revealed preferences don't provide answers. So what is revealed preferences, which most of you probably know, but standard economics basically says you can't believe what people say because there's no consequence to what they say, right? People can say anything and there's no trade-off. So you can only believe the data that's in revealed preferences, and revealed preferences are typically measured by consumption choices. You know, if you make a consumption choice, you're making a trade-off within a budget, and, you know, so that's a choice that's real, and therefore we can believe that data. And that's fine, and it works very well for lots of things, but there are a lot of questions where revealed preferences don't work at all. And I focus on two of those, and one is the welfare effects of institutional arrangements individuals are powerless to change, like inequality or macroeconomic volatility. So take a poor peasant in Bolivia who's made very unhappy by inequality. Well, short of emigrating or protesting, there's really not much that he or she can do about it to express his or her preference about inequality. Yet inequality may make them very unhappy. Same goes for bad governance. When people live under bad governance regimes, usually short of dangerous protesting, they can't do much about it. But they may be made very unhappy by that regime. And with happiness surveys, we can look at the effects of these kinds of different environmental or institutional conditions on well-being. And the second set of questions is behaviors that are driven by norms or by addiction and self-control problems. Alcohol and drug abuse, smoking, obesity. There's a famous paper by John Gruber and Sandel Milanathan that finds that cigarette taxes make smokers happier. That doesn't make any sense at all, that smoking is a real preference that people are really consuming. But if you think of smoking as a self-control problem, and higher taxes might help you not buy cigarettes, right? And then obesity is an area where I've worked a fair amount, and standard economics would say, under revealed preferences, that the obese are, that those are rational, optimal choices, revealed preferences, and the obese are just consuming more because they want to consume more. Well, it turns out the obese in the United States are significantly less happy than the non-obese. So if it's a revealed preference, why are they unhappy, right? Another area is when behaviors are driven by norms, and this is quite relevant to the study of poverty, which I do a lot. And if you think about a poor person in a lower caste in India that doesn't send his or her child to school, now you might say that's a revealed preference. Or you might just say that's a behavior that's driven by a very strong norm that says you're in a lower caste, your kid is going to be in a lower caste, it's going to go to a bad school, it's not going to get out of a lower caste. And you're in a norm you can't depart out of. And that might explain that behavior, even though that behavior may not be producing positive well-being. It might be making the poor peasant very unhappy. Again, we don't know through revealed preferences, but we can measure that with happiness surveys. Finally, even though economists for a long time shied away from reliance on surveys, for a number of reasons, they've started to use survey data on happiness a lot. One is that one of the things we find is consistent patterns in the determinants of well-being across large samples, across countries, and across time. There's something to this if the patterns are so consistent, but the variables that correlate with happiness, and I'll show you those in a minute. And also, psychologists find validation in the way that people answer these surveys, these, you know, questionnaires or interviews, in psychological measures of well-being, such as the number of genuine smiles, some frontal lobe in the brain things. I'm not a psychologist, so I don't really know what exactly how these things work, but they find validation between psychological measures of well-being and how people answer these surveys. Then we've also got a lot of econometric innovations that are helping us account for error and bias in survey data, and maybe with the error that exists in all kinds of data, that are also helping us get around some of the problems with survey data. The most important is kind of unobservable personality traits that could affect the way particular individuals answer surveys. And we're getting around that in lots of different ways, including new ways to compensate for that in cross-section data for any of those of you that work with data. And then finally, I guess I would argue that even though we've been very skeptical about survey data, that if you think income data is error-free, you're really missing the boat, particularly if you think about income data for third world countries, which is very hard for people to account for their salaries for, and there are a lot of incentives to not report income, right? I mean, particularly in places where tax systems are weak, people don't want to report their income. I would argue that there are a lot less incentives to lie to a happiness survey. What do you have to lose? I mean, why would you want to lie to a happiness survey? So for a number of reasons, I think we have some pretty strong, pretty much confidence that we can use these surveys and learn something. There are reasons to be very cautious. One is biases in the way people answer surveys. So if you don't design your survey right, or if you're unaware of certain things, say you interview, you're doing a happiness survey across Latin America, and you happen to do your interviews in Chile the day Peru beat them in soccer. You know, everybody's happiness survey is going to be biased way downward, and Chile wouldn't look very good compared to Peru. So that's the kind of thing we can get around more easily. And it's really important. The other thing, though, is it's very important to have the happiness question at the very beginning of the survey. It's an open-ended question, generally speaking, how happy are you with your life, or generally speaking, how satisfied are you with your life? And you want it the first question in the survey, because if you ask it after 10 questions about is your income enough, or are you happy with your marriage, or do you like your job, you can bias the results in lots of different directions. But a more fundamental problem, and again I'm going to talk more about this, is adaptation, right? So I talked about the set point theory. But what do you do with two data points? One is a millionaire who reports to be miserable and very unhappy, and one is a poor peasant who's adapted to his or her condition and or has low aspirations due to lack of information, who reports to be very happy. How do we use this data, and how do we use it in the policy area? This is what I've called the happy peasant versus frustrated achiever problem. And you'll see this is a big challenge for this line of research. You can learn a lot because the poor peasant is reporting to be happy despite terrible conditions, but it poses problems. Then there's another part of the story, which is something called the Easterlin paradox. At the country level, it's a country level paradox. And basically, Richard Easterlin, who started studying happiness in 1975, and is sort of godfather of all this stuff, found a conundrum, which was that even though within countries, wealthier people are happier than poor people, and across countries in a cross section, there is a modest pattern between average per capita level GDP and happiness, but it's a very modest pattern, that over time, countries didn't get happier, even though their income levels quintupled. And for example, Japan's income level quintupled in 3 decades, and their happiness levels dropped. The U.S., until about 2 years ago, was growing very rapidly for a developed economy, and over several decades, and happiness levels didn't increase at all. So that posed a conundrum. It's what got a lot of interest in this whole line of research to begin with, because if basic assumption in economics is that income is good, that's our measure of welfare, and that's a proxy for happiness or well-being, then what happens if people don't get happier when their income increases? What do we do with that? There's a whole new debate now, and actually a very vociferous one, and I find myself in the middle of it on sort of not taking either side. I feel like the bullets coming at me from both sides, in which a couple of new studies are challenging the Easterlin paradox using a different set of data and different questions. And so they're using a best possible life question, which asks respondents, how does your life What's the best possible life you can imagine? How does your life compare to that best possible life? And they ask people to put themselves on a 10-point scale. Well, it turns out that that question correlates much more closely with income, which makes sense. It frames things for the respondents. And if you ask somebody in Afghanistan, what's the best possible life? They know it's not in Afghanistan. Or if you ask somebody in Togo, So you frame the question, and it turns out that that correlates more closely with income. And so, as a result of that, several people are saying, no, we've overturned the Easterlin paradox. Just as a test of that, when I did my Afghanistan survey, I included an open-ended happiness question and the best possible life question. And it turned out that even though Afghans score higher than the world average on open-ended happiness, generally speaking, I'm pretty happy. But when you ask them the best possible life question, they score well below the world average. So again, part of that debate is question framing.
Question.
Yeah, sure.
Did the Easterlin paradox, with their associating changes in income, did they look at distribution of income or changes in distribution?
They didn't. One of Easterlin's explanations for why, as incomes increase, as average levels increase, people don't get happier is basically that it's all about relative income levels. Some of the studies in the U.S. have attributed the lack of increase in happiness due to the unequal distribution of income. And although, if you look at the distribution of happiness responses, they haven't changed the way income inequality is increased and happiness responses haven't changed correspondingly. So that's kind of and I've done some work looking at the effects of inequality on well-being, and it turns out that it very much depends on what it signals. So inequality makes people in Latin America, the poor in Latin America less happy and the rich happier, because it still signals persistent advantage for the rich and disadvantage for the poor. In the U.S., the only group that's made unhappy by inequality are left-leaning rich people. And I've looked at this with several data sets. In fact, there's a big story on this. I'm quoted all over Reuters today on this inequality stuff, because our inequality has increased so much. One question is, does the crisis change it? People still think we're the land of opportunity. That's why people aren't bothered by inequality in the United States. But so inequality, in a complicated way, is part of that, but we get very mixed results.
We're probably going to discuss this, but could it be that if unhappiness is also what drives people to become richer, you could have a consulting in the other direction.
That's a huge question. It's a big question in terms of migrants. So we find that migrants are unhappier than non-migrants in the city, and they're unhappier than rural people, right? But were they unhappy anyway, and so they migrated? Is there selection bias? Or does migrating make them unhappy? And in the absence of panel data, we don't know. But this is a happy, peasant, frustrated, achiever problem, and I'll get to it. I'll show you some stuff on economic growth as well. But I think it's a fundamental question. Do you need unhappiness for progress? But then we also find that happier people earn more money and are healthier and perform better in the labor market. So it goes in lots of directions. Okay, just on the Easterlin paradox, or if you happen to be interested in placing your country and figuring out where you are, if you look at this graph, which is mine from my work with Stefano Bettinato, so it's a little old, but this is percent above neutral on the life satisfaction question, and this is GDP per capita. And the red dots are mine. I'm very proud of them. I did the first survey of happiness in Latin America. And the blue dots are from the World Values Survey, which some of you may have used. So as you'll see, if you look at this chart, you could argue that there is or there isn't an Easterlin paradox, right? Because you could say, look, the rich countries are on average wealthier than the poor countries, so there's no Easterlin paradox. But if you look among the rich countries, there is no clear pattern. The Netherlands is extraordinarily happy, which doesn't really accord with what I know of the Netherlands, as my ex-husband's from Holland, so I do have some knowledge. But there's kind of a cultural way that people answer surveys that gets caught up in these average responses, and then there is sort of a cultural. Argentina's terrible. Argentina's by far the wealthiest. This is post-crisis in Latin America, and certainly not the happiest. And look at these poor, unequal countries. Guatemala, Honduras, Venezuela.
Happier than Costa Rica.
Which are happier than Costa Rica. And in fact, the two countries, go figure this, the two countries in Latin America that are most satisfied with their democracy are Costa Rica, yes, go figure, but the other is Venezuela. Makes all kinds of sense, right? Anyway, so the part of what's going on here is that when you do these average country level responses, you're not controlling for anything. You're just, you know, you're taking an average of the way people in a particular country answer the question, and there are big differences in cultural differences in the way people answer surveys. That's why Nigeria, for example. Nigeria always scores so high, I guess. But really, what we want to know is the determinants of happiness at the individual level. Because when we look at individual well-being, we can control for everything from individual personality traits to the country that people live in, to their income, their age, and all kinds of other things, and then figure out what are the most important determinants of happiness. So, what do we know? I'm going to skip this. If anybody wants to know how to do a happiness equation, I can come back to it. And I want to get to the results and run out of time. And for those of you that don't want to know how to do a happiness equation, you'll be relieved. Okay, so what do we know about happiness? This is a chart that may surprise some of you. And those of you that thought your 20s or 30s were it, you've got a long way to go. This is the pattern between happiness and years of age. This particular slide is for Latin America, but I have found this pattern to hold in Central Asia, Africa, Europe, the U.S., Latin America, Russia. You know, there's the low point on the happiness curve is somewhere between age 44 and age 50, depending on where you study it. The U.S. is about 44, Latin America is about 48, and I profess to be exactly there. And I'm from Peru, so I guess that's me. And then after that, people get, as long as people are healthy and in a stable partnership, they get monotonically happier until they die. So what explains this? Well, I think there's kind of a, you know, you finally figure out what you're going to grow up, be when you grow up by the year, and you learn to deal with it. This low point also often corresponds with a lot of financial burdens. Sometimes people have both young children or teenage children and older parents. And then after that, I think there is a sort of happy-to-be-alive effect. One could argue, our oldest respondent in the Latino Barometer was 99. One could argue there's a senility effect. But what's remarkable about this is that it really holds. That's true. Well, happier people live longer, so there's selection bias, too. Absolutely. Good point. I should have forgot to mention that. Yeah, the unhappy people have died off. People always say, also when the Scandinavian countries are both among the happiest in the world and also have the highest suicide rates, and people want to know how that accords. Well, first of all, people have committed suicide according to the survey. But it also turns out, this is part of the adaptation, the same way that people can adapt to very bad things. It's really terrible to be unhappy in a happy place. It makes you more unhappy because you stand out. Turns out, for example, in the United States, the happiest states also have the highest suicide rates. So it's better to be unemployed where there's lots of unemployment, and it's better to be unhappy where everybody's unhappy than where everybody's happy.
Does that parabola also hold if you're measuring levels of satisfaction?
Life satisfaction?
Life satisfaction.
Yeah, this is because in Latin America we actually used life satisfaction and happiness interchangeably sometimes in the same survey. They correlated about 0.55, the answers to happiness and life satisfaction questions.
Okay, I know there was some discussion about the whole parenting thing. Parents seem to be the most unhappy people around.
Yeah, but they're well,
but if you were to ask them if they were satisfied with their lives, they would say
different. Yeah, well, that comes to I'm going to get off track because this is some new stuff that's interesting. No. There are issues with that. When you compare people with children to people without children, there's a selection problem because you're comparing people who have chosen not to have children and are happy with that choice to people who have chosen to have children and are theoretically happy with that choice. Now, what happens is if you ask people from a moment-to-moment sense or if you measure their well-being at particular moments in the day, typically the time they spend with their children, they're very unhappy. But then when you ask someone what makes them happy with their lives, they say it's their children. But there's a difference, and this comes to the happy, peaceful, frustrated, achiever thing, and the question that Nora raised too. There's a difference between happiness and the kind of contentment moment-to-moment sense. So things that you do as you live, you know, as you just go through your day, and happiness in the sort of fulfillment or purposeful life sense. And I divide this into the Benthamite sense and the Aristotelian parts of happiness. And it turns out that the happiness in the moment-to-moment sense is measured by affect and everything else. economics correlates much less closely with income, for example, than does happiness in the life evaluation sense. And another issue, which I'll discuss a bit more at the end, is that poor people typically, and poor people in poor countries, and then people in poor countries more generally, typically find that religion, day-to-day friendships, all these things are more important to the happiness of poor people in poor countries, versus work and health is more important to the happiness of richer people, which is people with agency, people that can lead a purposeful life. So if you're stuck and you can't lead, you know, you can't pursue all these opportunities, you probably, you know, you emphasize the day-to-day things more, which is, I think, what explains the happiness of the Afghans. That's not all good, though, but I'll get to that at the end. Okay, so very quickly, this is just, you know, again, for those of you that don't like equations, don't worry, at least it reminds me of what to say. This is a comparison of the determinants of happiness across Russia, Latin America, and the United States. And we talked about age, the U holds for all three regions. It turns out they're remarkably similar, and the standard determinants of happiness are remarkably similar around the world. There's some differences. Women are happier than men in the United States, and men are happier than women in Russia, which accords with what you read or hear about gender relations there. And there's no gender difference in Latin America. Typically, married people are happier than non-married people everywhere you study happiness. Latin America that year, for some reason, wasn't statistically significant, but usually it is, and not in Russia. Marriage is not significantly correlated with happiness in Russia, again, according to some of what you read. Income is important to happiness everywhere we've studied it. So being destitute is terrible for happiness. Having enough income is important for happiness. After that, the relationship is complicated and nonlinear, in part because of something that came up earlier, which is the importance of relative incomes and keeping up with the Joneses and other things. Education. When you're controlling for income in the equation and then you also put in education, we typically get no effect. If you took income out, you'd get a positive effect of education. Well, when you put both in, you're also mixing up the correlation between income and education, and probably all you're picking up is highly educated people who may not be fulfilling what they want to be doing, and so you get much more mixed results on happiness. Minorities. In the United States, minorities are less happy than the average. That's driven by African Americans, not by Hispanics and Asians when you separate that out. In Latin America, people who self-report to be a minority rather than their country of origin are less happy than others. So it's the question is, you know, please tell me what you consider yourself most to be. And the first possible response is Chilean or Peruvian or Argentine, and the next one are a variety of ethnic groups. And so people that self-report to be of an ethnic group before they report to be of their nationality are less happy than others. There could be a directional causality issue there, but I won't get into it now. And then Russia, rather surprisingly, minorities are happier on average than native Russians. Now, if you think of this, the Russia work we did between 1995 and 2000, the time that the Soviet Union collapsed, and the status of native Russians compared to other groups fell dramatically, and minorities in a lot of ways got new rights they didn't have before, so that finally makes sense. Students, at least in the United States, are happier than others, so you should be happy with that. Retired people are happier in the U.S. than non-retired people, no effect in Latin America, and in Russia here are the unhappy pensioners that you read about. Unemployment is deleterious to happiness everywhere we've studied it, and in fact, long-term unemployment seems to be something that people never adapt back from. It's really bad for happiness. But, as I mentioned, it's less bad for happiness if there are more unemployed people around you. So you would think that, you know, if you're unemployed and there's a higher unemployment rate, you'd be worried because the probability of being reemployed is lower, but the stigma effect is much more important. So just not being stigmatized by unemployment seems to matter more than the probability of getting a job. Self-employed people are happier than the average in the U.S. and in Russia, and in Latin America, they're less happy than the average. And I think here, what you're finding, you're just picking up that self-employed people, at least in the U.S., are self-employed by choice, typically, right? They're working in in their jeans on their computer at home. They don't have a boss. Versus in Latin America, self-employed people, for the most part, are working in the informal sector and would probably love to have a stable, normal job. And then finally, health is incredibly important to happiness everywhere we've studied it and every way we measure it.
Quick question on that.
Sure.
Is that just a self-reported health question or something like that?
They vary. In Latin America, that's a self-reported health status question. In the U.S. and Russia, for these particular sites, it's a health index of the conditions. How many days did you miss last month compared to work? In fact, that stupid health question got us in trouble in Russia for the paper we did, because we were looking at, I can't remember what we were doing, but we had forgotten that the health question said, how many days did you miss, not go to work because you were ill? And we kept getting this negative correlation between, I think it was health and something to do with work. And then we realized that these people weren't going to work, so of course they weren't, are unhealthy people. But both sort of health condition measures of health and reported health correlate closely with happiness. Obviously, happier people are more likely to say their health is good, so their problems. It's not really their health. Okay, so what about adaptation? Oh, no, one more thing on kind of happiness, and then I'll turn to the adaptation results. One question we had was, well, we know that wealthier people are happier, so income seems to cause happiness, at least to a certain degree. Do happier people earn more money? Does happiness cause income? And here we had data for the same people for several years in a row in Russia, and we were able to... basically, what we did in a first stage regression, we put happiness. We had happiness on the left hand side, and we controlled for everything we could control for age, marriage, education, all these other things. And for each respondent, their residual term was kind of their unexplained happiness level. What wasn't explained by everything else, and was probably as close as we could get to kind of their natural happiness level that wasn't explained by environmental conditions. And then we included that as an independent variable in a second stage regression with income as a dependent variable, and we got very consistent results on unexplained happiness being important, at least being correlated with future income. Now, there are lots of criticisms of this result, and a colleague of mine, Gary Bertless at Brookings, basically said, well, look, you know what it is? It's just these people in 1995 that were happier in 1995 because they could predict their income in the year 2000. So you're just picking up, their long-term happiness about their long-term income and their earnings capacity. But I would argue here, doing this in a rather funny context like Russia, where not too many people in 1995 could predict what they were going to be doing in the year 2000, at least eliminates that criticism. There are plenty of others, but there's some psychological studies that also suggest that happier people do better in the labor market, they earn more money. Interestingly enough, though, and this speaks to Nora's question, the psychological studies find that they use a scale of 1 to 9. So they find the 7s and the 8s on the happiness scale do very well, but the 9s don't do as well. So you can be too happy, at least in income.
Well, the majority of your happiness, at least in Russia, was unexplained happiness.
Yeah, it's very low. Yeah, most happiness equations end up with very low scores because there's so much of this, just natural character traits driving things, and so it raises huge direction of causality issues. So will happier people report to be healthier, are unhappy people more likely to be concerned about inequality? There are lots of questions like that throughout this stuff. Okay, let me tell you a little bit about adaptation. How much time do I have? Okay. All right. Well, I will try and zip through. So, in the economics arena, we find some paradoxes that suggest that a lot of adaptation goes on. One is something Eduardo Lora and I have called the paradox of unhappy growth, and this is with the worldwide Gallup World Poll data, where we looked at both the effects of average GDP per capita on average country levels of happiness and the effects of economic growth rates. And it turned out that, not surprisingly, average, so levels of income were positively correlated with life satisfaction, standard of living, health satisfaction, job satisfaction, housing satisfaction, all these things, as you would expect. But controlling for levels, it turned out that countries with higher rates of growth had lower levels of life satisfaction, lower satisfaction with their standard of living, and lower satisfaction with their health. Sunia Chattopadhyay and I did the same thing on an individual basis for Latin America, and we got very similar results. So what does this mean? One way to get at it, we divided the sample into people above median income and people below median income, countries, I mean, and then countries above median growth rates and countries below median growth rates. And we found the finding only held for countries above median income and for countries above median growth rates, suggesting that the finding is driven by fast growth in relatively wealthy countries, not by poor countries just coming out of poverty. And I think it's the Brazils and the Koreas and the Chinas. And in those places, we find that there are lots of things about very rapid growth that's very unsettling. It's accompanied by inequality, by changing rules of skill sets, by people having to move and relocate, and all kinds of things that could be associated with unhappiness. So if you think about, we talked about migrants already, but some of what we find in China has a lot to do with the unhappiness of migrants, people that have moved to cities. There are my happy peasants and frustrated achievers, which is a finding that got me into the happiness work about 10 years ago, where I was looking at overtime data on respondents in Peru and found that of the people that had the most income mobility, so the people that moved out of poverty the most, over half of them reported to be unhappy with their economic situation 10 years later, right? So we knew how they'd done in income terms, and then when we compared the perception, there was this, you know, frustrated achiever effect. We found the same thing for Russia and the same thing for China now. So it suggests that there are things about progress, about the economic development process, which is probably captured in that growth finding, that make people unhappy. Another issue is the whole role of adaptation. People adapt very quickly to gains, and they're averse to losses. So there's work that finds, for example, that people adapt to a salary increase within a year. It's completely forgotten. Versus a promotion, the happiness effects of a promotion last 5 years. And then there's also work that shows that losses, any kind of income loss, has a much stronger negative effect on happiness than a gain does. So when, you know, when everybody's gaining, the positive happiness effect is ephemeral and often just gets washed out because all tides are rising at the same time. Now, what about crises? Crises are terrible for happiness. I've done work on Russia and Argentina during crises, but here's some new stuff that's kind of interesting. This is based on daily data from the Gallup organization. So we interview 1,000 people a day in the United States, nationally representative, sampled by cell phone and by landline. And we compared their responses throughout the crisis with what was going on with the Dow. So these are, the blue line is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The red line are average happiness levels, okay? If you looked at the happiness of the unemployed or vulnerable groups, you'd get a different finding. This is just average for the United States. Here's the beginning of the crisis. Here's right in here. Here's the Lehman Brothers collapse. What we found is that average happiness levels dropped dramatically with the crisis. They fell 11% from the start of this period until the lowest point, which was right around in here. National average levels don't move very much, if at all. So an 11% drop is huge, right? They usually don't move. They're very stable. So, you know, in 3 decades, U.S. average happiness levels have been the same. So an 11% drop in several months was giant. But then what happened? In March of 2009, the bottom stopped falling out of markets. Okay, recovery sort of sputters up. It's not great, but in this period, people didn't know when it would end. There was tremendous uncertainty. What happened? Average happiness levels sparked way up, even to higher than pre-crisis levels. The same respondents say that their economic situation is worse than it was before. So it's not a Pollyanna effect. People accepted they've lost some wealth. But what happened? The uncertainty stopped. And so one of the things we find is that people cannot adapt to uncertainty. They can adapt to unpleasant certainty much better than they can adapt to uncertainty. And I'll show you some examples from the health arena in a minute. But let me, speaking about adaptation, let me turn to crime and corruption.
Excuse me? No. Tell me, it looks like that the happiness received the downfall. That's right.
Did it what?
The happiness received the downfall.
The recovery.
The recovery? Well, this spike here is New Year's Day, so that's just random. That's a holiday spike. But yeah, it's sort of around here it gets better. But the big spike
Obama
up.
The Obama effect.
Yeah. Well, Obama was inaugurated every year.
No.
Was it? Yeah, that's right. But this is, this could be, but we looked at, we actually did regressions with all kinds of events. We have these event dummies for all the events in the crisis, Obama's inauguration, Michael Jackson's death, all kinds of events, to see how they affected happiness levels. And it bummed me out, but the Obama inauguration was not a, it wasn't a big positive boost that day. I think because the country's so divided politically, so maybe half the people were happy and half weren't.
In logical terms, wouldn't we expect it that there would be some sort of delay effect? Because all these, the crisis and so on, it's not affecting you immediately, but it's going to start affecting you. You know, you lose your job 2-3 months after these things and so on. But the data is showing that it's like a direct effect. I mean, it seems like it's like a kind of like direct correlation. Is it more like perceptions than actual reality, what's happening?
Absolutely. And one of the things we did is we tested different cohorts and how they were affected by the events of the crisis. And it turns out that more kind of wealthier people with more to lose were much more affected by the signaling effects, both of the ongoing crisis and the recovery. Their happiness levels were much more sensitive, so they fell more into versus very vulnerable groups. People without health insurance, unemployed, their happiness levels were flatter. They still had this U, but it's not as sharp, and they were lower, and they just responded less to events. It's almost as though, they're already vulnerable, they're just trying to get through day-to-day life, and they have less to lose. So people are loss averse, and you have uncertainty affected people with more to lose more. Okay, I have to keep going because I need to do crime and corruption and health in 10 minutes, so. Okay. This is all about adapting to good and bad times. So about 10 years ago, I came out of my house in Northwest DC. I was waving at my kids, didn't look at the car, got in the car and tried to drive off. It wouldn't go anywhere. Swearing, got out, slammed the door, had places to go, things to do. And I looked and my Honda was on blocks. And this doesn't happen in Northwest DC. You don't find your tires stolen very often. So I was outraged, it ruined my day, the police came, this never happens. And it just seemed like a calamity. But if it had happened to me in Lima, where I'm from, my reaction would have been, you stupid idiot, why did you leave the car on the street? You know the tires would get stolen, right? Same person, completely different norms of crime. So one of the things we find is that bad things matter less to people who are used to a lot of bad things, to the happiness people, and good things matter more to people that have more of them. So crime matters less to the well-being of people used to a lot of crime and corruption. And for example, democracy matters positively to well-being across the world, but democracy and freedom matter more to the happiness of people who live in countries that are used to having democracy and freedom. So just looking at crime and corruption, this is the effect of crime on happiness in Latin America. The dependent variable is happiness. We did this lots of ways, and you could dispute this particular econometric strategy, but we get the same finding doing it other ways. But what we did is we did a first-stage regression where we had being a victim of crime as the dependent variable, and all the things that might explain the probability of being a crime victim on the right-hand side, and then we isolated the unexplained probability of being a crime victim as a residual variable, and included that in this next stage regression where happiness is a dependent variable. And what do we find? We find that being a crime victim is negatively correlated with well-being. But if you live somewhere where there's just more unexplained crime around you, just random crime that isn't predicted by your income level or your area of residence or anything else. It's just, you know, a city or a location where there's more crime. That mitigates the negative effect of being a crime victim. Also, we did labs. I'm not going to get into those, but sort of crime in the past doesn't bother you very much. You forget about it fairly quickly. We did the same thing with corruption and get the exact same results. So if you're a corruption victim, it makes you less happy. But if you're a corruption victim where there's more unexplained corruption around you, that seems to mitigate the effect of being a corruption victim. We did something similar in Africa. Here are people who report to live in places where there's security in their neighborhood, that, you know, they feel relatively safe in their neighborhood. And here are people who report to have low levels of personal security in their neighborhood. So in both, we find that being a frequent victim of crime victimization is bad for well-being, but it's much worse for well-being. The coefficient's much more higher in negative terms, if that makes any sense. In places where people report to be in secure neighborhoods. So if you don't expect to be a victim, if you think your neighborhood's supposed to be safe and you're victimized, the effects on your well-being are more. And if you expect to be a victim of crime, you just kind of deal with it. You adapt to it. The most striking findings on this end are in Afghanistan, where what did we find? Being a victim of crime had no significant effect on well-being because people are so used to it. And corruption had no significant effect on well-being except in one place, and that was in Taliban-influenced districts. Well, we didn't interview in war zones, but we did interview in some districts that had more Taliban presence than others, and there the corruption rates, actual corruption rates, were significantly lower, and there, if you were a victim of corruption, you were very unhappy, because why? It's not usual, you don't expect it, you felt stigmatized by it. So the long and the short of it is people can adapt to very bad equilibrium to
domestic violence.
In Afghanistan?
No.
No. This crime is petty crime. I'm sure domestic violence is. I'm sure it's got very negative effects on well-being. One of the things...
But we just have an adaptation also.
If you can adapt to that.
If it's more common.
People adapt to it. It's interesting, a recent finding about the effects of the internet on well-being. It turns out that access to the internet is positively associated with well-being in developing countries, particularly in countries where gender rights are unequal, and particularly for women in those countries, which suggests to me that the internet creates a way for women who are either abused or to communicate. So that doesn't really answer your question, but it's suggestive. Anyway, people can adapt to bad things, and that's kind of not a great story. Okay, so very quickly, health. Where are my circles? Maybe they'll pop up if they went away. Shoot, it's not here. Okay, well, this is something that you can't see now, but it's called the Millennium Preston Curve.
What is this correction bias? What is this fair?
Were you a victim of crime in the past year? Or were you a victim of corruption in the past year?
Well, what does it mean, of corruption?
So you self-report?
You self-report whether
what is a typical crime?
In the corruption question we asked about, right. We specified it as bribe, you know, and a couple of other things.
Bribe.
Yeah. Okay, so I was going to try and explain a slide where the dots didn't seem to translate well, but it's called the Millennium Preston Curve. And it's got life expectancy on this axis and per capita income on that axis. And what you get is that as increases, very modest increases in income in very poor countries, you get huge gains in life expectancy. So the curve is very sharp, and then it flattens out. Looks almost like the Easterland paradox curve that I showed you. And what's going on is that when people are in very poor countries, very modest interventions in health and very small increases in income result in big gains in life expectancy, and you're raising life expectancy from, say, 40 to 45 to 45 to 50, which is much easier to do than in the wealthy countries. You're trying to raise life expectancy from, 75 to 80, and it's no longer just about income. It's about technology and trying to cure things like cancer. So and it very much mirrors the kind of Easterland paradox, where income and happiness are more closely correlated down here, and then it flattens out a bit. So my question was, does health satisfaction, does the relationship between health satisfaction and actual health the same thing. In other words, when you're very unhealthy and you make modest, you know, you improve people's health, their health satisfaction should increase, but maybe that flattens out as people get healthier and expect to have better health. Well, that's sort of the story. But one of the things that we find is that tolerance varies tremendously across countries, cohorts, and cultures, and that health satisfaction very closely correlates with cultural norms of health. So we find, for example, that health satisfaction is as high in Kenya as it is in the U.S., I've mentioned that already, and higher in Guatemala than it is in Chile, even though objective conditions in Chile are at OECD levels and objective conditions in Guatemala are pretty much at African levels. So that doesn't make sense. And then national average health satisfaction is only weakly correlated with GDP per capita, and it's negatively correlated with growth, I showed you that. It's weakly and positively correlated with life expectancy, as you would think, but it's also positively correlated with the infant mortality rate, which makes no sense at all. So one of the things we find is that health satisfaction has a lot to do with what the cultural norm of good health is. So people can have very bad health and report to be very satisfied with their health. Again, adapting to bad equilibrium, reporting to be happy, poses a lot of problems if you're trying to use this data to do any kind of real work on health. So, good, at least that side came through. Here's another example of the role of norms in determining health satisfaction. This is work on obesity in the United States, and this is based on a depression scale, not a happiness scale. And what this is the base impact of obesity on happiness in the United States is 0.57 standard deviations higher on the depression scale. So that is for a white obese person with income in the middle income quintile living in a non-urban area in the East, right? Is 0.57 points, 0.57 standard deviations higher on the depression scale than their non-obese counterparts. But the interesting part of this story is this. Relative to whites, if you're Hispanic or black, the impact of obesity on happiness is much lower. Why? Because obesity rates are much higher. It's kind of more the norm. If you are wealthy, the obesity impact is worse because there are less obese people in wealthier socioeconomic cohorts. And if any region compared to the East Coast where there's less obesity, it's better to be obese because there are more obese people around you. And if you live in a city, it's worse to be obese because there are less obese people around you. We also did this for professions and found that if you work in a low-skilled profession, the impact of obesity was much lower. You don't depart from the weight norm for your profession if you're obese, versus if you worked in a high-skilled profession and you departed from the weight norm, the impact of obesity was terrible. So it suggests, again, that people can conform to very bad norms of health and that they have other implications. In this case, we found that the obese were much less likely to have upward mobility than the non-obese. We don't know if it's because of discrimination or because of expectations or what it might be. But it's, you know, really suggesting that norms play a big role here. And this is the kind of thing that you can't analyze with standard income data, right? This is where happiness surveys give us some insights that you wouldn't otherwise have. Okay. A last slide. This is back to the whole issue of uncertainty. So we had data for Latin America on life and health satisfaction and everything else, you can imagine, and something called the EQ5D index, the Euroquality Five Dimensions Index. And you ask people if they've had problems, either no problems, moderate problems, or extreme problems with mobility, self-care, the usual acts, which is going to work, leisure, everything you would typically want to do in a day, pain or anxiety. And one of the things, and then here we did these, I don't have time to get into the details, but we did something called income equivalences where you calculate what amount of money you would need to lose to produce the same amount of happiness drop with the income that the health condition caused. And we found that the only conditions that really mattered to life satisfaction were moderate problems with the usual acts, people not being able to do what they expect to do normally, and then pain and anxiety were huge. And these conditions are very much associated with uncertainty. You don't really know when they're going to get you. We also find there's some different work that shows that while people can adapt to spinal cord injury, things like uncontrolled epilepsy are terrible for happiness. because you don't know when it's going to hit you. You can't adapt to things that, you know, that are very uncertain because your coping mechanisms don't work. So that's just an example from the health arena about what people can and can't adapt to. Notice mobility problems, which were featured, are not on here. You know, people that have mobility problems adapted to. Okay, I'm going to skip that. So among other things, there's a lot of evidence that people can adapt to both prosperity and adversity, right? So and that they can adapt to uncertainty, even positive uncertainty. Growth, in a way, economic growth, is a form of positive uncertainty. Everything's changing for the better, so, but it's uncertain. You don't really know. And at the individual level, this might be a good thing, at least from the psychological level perspective. But at the collective level, though, I think it could result in societies getting stuck in bad equilibrium. You think about Afghanistan, you think about the crime and corruption findings, or the health findings. And when societies are stuck in this kind of equilibrium that's very much driven by norms, it's very difficult to change them, right? If everybody around you is corrupt, it's really difficult to behave honestly. In fact, it's counterproductive. You know? So when everybody conforms to bad norms, I think you do get societies stuck in bad equilibrium. And this, in turn, raises, I think, a real note of caution about applying happiness surveys directly to policy. Because this difference in norms and tolerance for adversity means that people can report to be happy in conditions that most of us would consider intolerable. It doesn't mean we can't learn a lot that's policy relevant from these surveys, but we need to be very careful about how we do it. And then there are a bunch of other questions. Again, as I mentioned, as this is being pushed into the policy arena, I think before we're really ready for it to be, there's some other unresolved questions. So one, and we've spoken to a bit about it, is that happiness surveys work as a research tool because they don't define happiness for the respondent, right? Which is this open-ended question at the beginning of the survey, and it's why I think we can compare and get very good patterns, consistent patterns from people in China and Chile and Afghanistan and the United States, because we're not imposing an American definition of happiness on the Chinese or a Brazilian definition of happiness on Germans. But if we're going to think about happiness as a policy objective, right, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is in the Constitution, then I do think we require a definition, right, before we're going to implement it or think about it as a policy objective. And there's the Benthamite, happiness is contentment, and the Aristotelian, happiness is leading a fulfilling life, as two extreme definitions. And obviously, one or the other would be better or more acceptable objectives of policy. I personally think an Aristotelian definition is the only one that should be in a policy arena, but I'm making a normative judgment. That's one individual. There's no public consensus on that, and I think it would vary a lot across countries. And then this has led me to think a lot about, Nora, the question you raised about, you know, does it take unhappy people to make progress? And it strikes me that the people select into different definitions of happiness depending on agency, depending on what they're capable of and of the opportunities that they have. So yes, you're going to value or conceive of happiness in your life or being happy in your life as leading a fulfilling life if you have the agency to do that. But if you don't, you know, if you're stuck in Afghanistan or a very poor neighborhood in Peru, you know, it might very well be that yes, you value friendships and safety nets more because that's, and religion and whatever else it might be, because those are the, you know, you're dealing with the opportunities that you have. And it may also be that the process of gaining agency, right, the process of changing that situation, which is most visibly notable in migrants, right? Migrants make a physical move to get agency, to either lead a better life themselves or to give opportunities for their children to go to school in a better place and have better health. That process produces unhappiness, unless they were less happy to begin with, which is kind of the research conundrum we're still stuck in. But and it strikes me so that this idea also speaks a little bit to Sen's criticism of the happiness literature, saying, oh, well, you know, these peasants report to be happy, you have to think about it in terms of capabilities. But I actually think that the happiness stuff is telling us a lot about capabilities and agency. And the fact that people can report to be happy in intolerable conditions suggests to me that they don't have agency. And that is important policy relevant information. Okay, one other question is, sounds a little noinky, but cardinality versus ordinality. So these happiness surveys are ordinal in nature, they're not cardinal. So we just have people placing themselves in categories that run from very unhappy to very happy. But if we're thinking about policy, do we care more about making somebody who's miserable and very depressed less miserable, or about making somebody who's already happy, you know, very happy? That's, again, it's a normative question, but what we pull out of these surveys is not answering that question. We're just looking at categories of happiness. And then lastly, intertemporal problems. Do we care about happiness today versus happiness tomorrow, the happiness of our children? And there are a lot of things that increase aggregate welfare in the long term and will hopefully make our children better off, such as reducing our national deficits and maybe defeating the Taliban in Afghanistan, whether you believe it or not. But lots of things that don't bring short-term happiness to mind, and yet they may be very important to aggregate welfare and longer-term happiness. And again, what we are doing in terms of research and method is not speaking to that problem at all. So, just to conclude, this isn't to dismiss the approach. I think we're learning a lot, particularly about questions that revealed preferences don't answer very well, like the welfare effects of different environment conditions, commuting time, institutional arrangements, norms, health conditions. But like anything new, we're working to get the science right, and hopefully before the increased publicity that we're getting gets better.
Very much. We have a few minutes to take questions. We'll take two or three and start with Jimmy.
Okay. I'm going to pull a page from Marshall Seligman's field of positive psychology, or at least my understanding of it, in a very reductionistic way, and say that happiness is a state of mind. One can will happiness or make oneself happy. And then ask the question about the research here. What about the consumption of prescribed psychotropic medications, in other words, Xanax, or things that make people feel happy in conditions when otherwise they might not? Because, you know, there's a phenomenon in the United States that we're over-medicating children to make their lives happier. So did that factor into the kind of like the evaluations of societies that express happiness? Is it correlated to what kind of medications they may be taking?
Not across countries, because these happy peasant societies don't do that, right. You could argue that, you know, just is Prozac affecting reported happiness levels in the United States? I don't know. I don't think the sample size of people that would otherwise be very depressed that are reporting very happy could drive the overall findings. But you know, there's probably something to that. I do have kind of a deeper answer to that, though, which comes from some new research a colleague of mine did in Britain, where he had extensive data on, probed deeper into some of these questions with a smaller sample of people. And one of the things, it was what people would want if policy were applied to happiness as the overall question. And one of the questions people were asked is if they could just take a pill to be happy, or if they had to work their whole lives to find their own happiness, which would they prefer? And 93% wanted to find their own happiness. There weren't very many people who just wanted to take a happy pill. I don't know how long.
So, one of the things you talked a lot about was adaption and also this Venn-like version of happiness. So I guess my question is if I'm a social planner, and I like Bentham-like happiness, and people adapt quickly to changes in income, shouldn't I just throw lots of parades and circuses instead of building roads?
Sure.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've written a fair amount about, and in that science review that I picked up on, is one of the dangers of this approach is that you can think of malevolent dictators who just poll people in search of happiness and say, they don't like inflation, they don't like this, they like parades and circuses, and they're much less happy when they learn more, so let's keep them all dumb and happy. And one of the experiments that's often pointed to is Bhutan, which has this concept of gross national happiness. And in the period that they've had gross national happiness, they've increased literacy, they've democratized, they've opened up their economy. But they had an incredibly enlightened king who wanted to democratize. In fact, he came, when he was crown prince, he came to see me when I was, at that point, vice president for governance at Brookings. And I thought he wanted to come talk about happiness, and I was all excited. And all he wanted to talk about was democratization. But the point about Bhutan is that, so you can look at the Bhutan experiment and say, no, you know, it doesn't, look, here's a country that's had gross national happiness, and look at all the progress in it. One, it had very much to do with an enlightened dictator or king. And two, even now, the progress that they've made is starting to show up as real problems, like kids on the internet. They've been trying to preserve their cultural homogeneity and part of this whole gross national happiness thing. And what they're finding is that all the pressures of increased aspiration, globalization, and access to the internet are sort of all of a sudden getting mixed up in everything. And so there is some of this progress-related unhappiness going on now there, too. So if you weren't an enlightened king or dictator, you might not want that to happen.
That's where the Romans had the serpents.
Lauren, then.
What's your next book?
I'm working on a book on happiness and policy, actually, from the Brookings, which is, it's really taking some of these last more philosophical questions and saying, wait a minute, you know, everybody's talking about happiness and policy, here are these questions that we haven't resolved. But I'm mostly behind them, so.
What is it, how to incorporate the collective element in this analysis? I'm thinking, you mentioned the capability approach. And the capability approach, sense approach, in terms of assessing this, some of these ideas, is telling us that it's not necessarily an individual, you know, exercise, you know, your pursuance of, you know, all your potential as individual, but also that you're restrained by lots of social constraints, norms that are imposed to you, in many cases from, you know, day zero or something. And this is a little bit linked to the idea of social capital, that when you, in the sense that we kind of rely on our kind of extended social networks to accomplish certain things, but this exercise seems to be more focused on the, at the individual level, in the surveys and so on. And when you do the exercise for countries, sometimes it seems kind of, you know, too massive to kind of have these different these differentiations in terms of, you know, social groups, because what a lot of people do is you retract you, you know, to people that share the same kind of features with you. You know, if you're wealthy, you're going to gather around wealthy people, and then you, like, you put that's your social capital, and you separate from the rest of society. The basic question is, how do you incorporate these collective ideas in the research?
Well, one of the, and it's one of the sort of criticisms I've had of the work on inequality, where a lot of people say, oh, well, inequality doesn't matter, happiness, well-being, and what they do is they do these cross-country regressions for the Gini coefficient on the right-hand side, you can see it, that's right. And I say, well, inequality matters to people depending on different reference norms. And, you know, the country-level Gini doesn't capture all that. The average Joe doesn't work with the Gini coefficient in their countries. I mean, obviously, it's a measure. So some of what we did with our inequality work was looking at whether people lived in small, medium, or large-sized cities, and how the effects of inequality vary. And it turns out it matters more for a big city where the reference norm is bigger and there's more inequality. But there's also some work that's been done on things like neighborhood and participating in religion and all kinds of other stuff in the happiness literature, where you find smaller groupings where you're able, you know, if you have neighborhood level data or data on participation in organizations, or John Halliwell has done a lot of work on social capital and well-being in Canada, where they have very good data on organizational participation and structure. So there is some of that.
But is there a correlation?
I think the country, I agree with you, country level aggregates for this kind of thing don't.
And is there a correlation? Is people socializing, having strong social networks and happiness as well?
Yes, there is. It's positive correlated. There's a version of causality issue, so maybe happier people are more likely to socialize. And then the effect of that varies. So in Latin America, we find, for example, that having friends or family you can rely on in time of need are most important to the happiness of the poor after having enough food to eat. Versus for the rich, it's work and health, much more individualistic kind of. And I think that goes back around to the agency and capabilities question, which is not that all social capital
falls into this category, but that people who are sort of pursuing an individual objective are less likely to need and or belong to these, you know, social networks versus poor people that need, you know, the social networks make are not only a positive thing for the well-being sense, but often a safety net.
Have you done any work with kind of major world religious values of major groups?
The findings on religion are typically that people that have religion are happier than, or have some sort of faith, are happier than people that don't. Again, direction of causality, maybe happier people are more likely to believe in something, but there's some evidence that some of it just has to do with the kind of positive externalities that come from religious participation. There's a great study in Europe by my friend Andrew Clark, who finds that religious people are happier than non-religious people. But even atheists are happier when they live in more religious neighborhoods. So there is some sort of positive spillover effect from having more religiosity around them. But there's a big but here, and that is that this is in a place where religion is a moderate force. It's, you know, Protestants and Catholics across Northern Europe. Versus when I looked at religion, I looked at it in Central Asia and Afghanistan, there was no positive correlation between having a religious identification and happiness. And I think there it's because in those societies, religion is a divisive force. It almost forces an identity.
But I was thinking of, let's say, of Buddhists.
Oh, are Buddhists happier?
In a global sense, and all the values inculcated right through years and centuries of religious tradition change your notion of happiness.
That I
haven't.
I think it's a great question, but I can't answer.
So we have 5 minutes. You had your hand up, and the other woman. Please be brief in your statements.
I'm wondering, you were talking about how this happiness relates to policy. So how would you view happiness in terms of growth when you're talking about Eastern European countries that may be reporting to be the least happy, or South Africa, which reports to be less satisfied than it did under apartheid?
Eastern, I'm going to answer them separately because there's data on both and they're for different reasons. So in Eastern Europe, we saw happiness drop dramatically with the collapse of income. And it's recovered almost back to where it was before. We don't have great data and we only have data at the start of the collapse. We don't have data pre that, so we can't really compare it to happiness in Soviet times. But if dimensions have changed so that people now are more financially satisfied and they're less satisfied with other things like family life and other things. What you almost would expect when you think about moving from a situation where you had great child care and all kinds of other things to much more freedom and lots more hassles. South Africa, I think the findings there I don't know well enough to know to what extent they're driven by falling happiness among whites and stable or increasing happiness among blacks, and also by, you know, dividing neighborhoods or whatever. But one could see that that's a place where there's sort of a change and progress effect that in the short term is possibly negative. A good example of this are both Korea and Ireland. There's some historical work that's looked at well-being levels during the period, you know, the Irish miracle and the Korean miracle growth of years. And the first 5 years, in both cases, produced drops in happiness. And then the second 5 years, happiness levels restabilized and went back up, suggesting that the period of change, uncertainty, turmoil, in these cases associated with very rapid growth, produced unhappiness. But then as people got used to it, things changed and stabilized, and happiness increased, a little bit like the crisis in the West Side.
So you talked about how uncertain or unstable environments are inversely correlated with happiness. I wonder if there's been any work on individuals, either in psychology, literature, or whatever, looking at whether some individuals are better able to handle those sorts of conditions so that they might kind of ties into Tom's point about the intervention. not for a social religion reason, but more of a personal outlook approach?
I don't fully know. My work on the crisis in the U.S., I'm looking across all these cohorts, you know, sort of vulnerable versus less vulnerable cohorts, suggests to me that people with more to lose are more bothered by uncertainty. And it may be that people that value material goods more are more bothered by uncertainty because they don't want to lose them, right? Versus if you live a Buddhist kind of life, you know, pair with the inflation if it's necessary. There's some work that suggests that unhappier people are more likely to value material goods more, and therefore that's why they're less satisfied with their financial situations. I'm not answering you very well, but it's kind of, I can get around that question more carefully.
When you spoke about happiness and health, you said that it should be adjusted to cultural things, to get a day of attention. And then you mentioned that because they need to be so candid, you can compare it to the support of the country. Now, I would think that the individuals themselves should be adjusted to cultural things. So if you compare three countries, Russia, Brazil, and the United States, and the way how you deal with the question is very different. He got Hawaii. You will not go and speak about your problems. In Russia, you sit down, you can stand up, and you speak about everything which happens. So I wondered why the Russian on longitudinal monitoring in the survey questionnaire was so long.
I'm not suggesting that Russia is a happier in your square down there. But this will definitely influence the quality of the survey.
Right, which is why I said that, well, first of all, you've always got to trade off between, if you try and adjust all your surveys for each country, then you can't make cross-country comparisons. You can learn more about the countries, individual countries, but you can't compare the data points. So it's just a trade-off depending on what you want to do. If you want to learn more about Russia's health, you can adjust your survey and do that accordingly. But secondly, it's why I said when I did the happiness in countries chart that in the end that data was not that useful because you were just capturing cultural differences in the way people answer happiness questions. When we do this at the individual level across, you know, hundreds of thousands of people across the world, and then we control for the country they're in, country down in the regression, at the least we're sort of separating out the cultural differences in the way people might answer surveys or other any other sort of country-specific errors.
Squeeze in one last one.
Just in the current climate, I was curious if you, in the United States, if there's any correlation with political party and happiness.
Yeah, this is a funny one, but Republicans are happier than Democrats, and we looked again at that during the crisis, and that finding held. And indeed, we also found that Republicans were Democrats were more sensitive to the signs of the ongoing crisis. And then, Republicans were more sensitive to the signs of the ongoing crisis and less positive about the recovery. And Democrats were sort of pretty similar, a little less sensitive to the signs of the ongoing crisis and then more positive about the recovery. The Democrats were very unhappy on the day of the TARP program, the bank bailout.
Shouldn't believe what they say about all those angry Tea Parties out there.
I think they're outliers.